So we have the sort of normal PI stuff of one lecture a day, every day for 3 weeks, which is actually a nice way to teach a course. I'm sure, burdens your schedules tremendously for those 3 weeks. But it gives us a way of focusing on a topic. So the way I think about this is this course is the first half of the implementations course that I normally teach at the university. And in that first half, what I want to do is to tell you, hey, this is in general how quantum devices work. And then the second half, we look at some details of this is a quantum device. And so that's the flavor of what we're going to do. Now, since it's taught in this more condensed version, then what we will do is we'll have lectures, there'll be tutorials, I'll give you homework assignments, there'll be no exams in for this first 3 week period. But I do want to see the homeworks, and we do want to see the tutorials. The tutorials are probably the most important piece, right? Because it gives you a chance to sit there and explore some aspect of quantum mechanics in more details than we can cover quickly in a class. And so the tutorials, they'll be led by Sarah, who's here, and by Miriam, and I believe a few people from IQC. There'll be two sets of tutorials. There'll be a tutorial here, and then there's a tutorial at Rack 2 on Wednesday and Friday from 1 to 2:30. And then the final thing I'm going to do this year, which I didn't do last year, is to schedule an extra hour once a week, which is not required at all. Just a chance that we can have a bit more discussion. So what I'll do in that extra hour is I'll talk to you about some experiment, which in my mind either, well, usually the theory is botched in a interesting way and give you a chance to sort it out. Okay. I don't know when those are. Do you know? Okay. Perfect. So we'll find a time and figure out how that works here. Okay. Any questions on those pieces? Yes, please. So yes, the tutorials, we'll set up a set of tutorials at Rack 2. So Rack 2 is on the UW campus. So just barely, you go as far north as you can, and just before you hit the cornfields, there's a building. And that's where we're located. So they'll be there, which is a little bit more convenient to get to than here. Yeah. There'll be two sets of tutorials. There's a tutorial for the Perimeter Institute people that will be here, and there'll be a tutorial at Rack 2 for those taking it through the university. Yeah. And I suppose for an individual, we could figure out that you could take either. But as a mass, we should try to make those to accommodate the schedules. Yeah? Okay. Other questions? Okay, I'm going to give you, and they're already up on the web for the first two lectures, a set of notes. And I've written these notes in Mathematica, and I'm not going to go over them. I'll use bits and pieces of them in the lecture, but they're for you to go over. The problems are embedded in there. There are some demonstrations, and a bit more material than we'll actually cover in class. And although they're written in Mathematica, I exported them as a CDF file. So if you go to Wolfram, you can download a CDF player, and that will allow you to run these programs without having to buy Mathematica. So you'll be able to manipulate them. You won't be able to change the code. If you want to change the code, you have to get Mathematica, which is available to all of you at the university or through Perimeter. But you don't need that for this class. Okay, just download the CDF player and you'll have access to these. How many people have used Mathematica? So just about everyone. Good. All right, so let's start. So the premise of the course is that quantum mechanics is outside of our everyday experience. So if we think about quantum mechanics, it's pretty nice. We can prove that we can do things by quantum mechanics that you can't do in the world that you're used to walking around in. And even better than that, we can prove that these are useful things to do, that we can change the efficiencies in some interesting way, whether we're building a sensor or an actuator or a communication channel or a processor. And so we would like to build quantum devices. And quantum mechanics is bloody, bloody easy to understand the theory of in small systems, much easier than classical mechanics. And so you think, well, we can understand it even though we can't see it in the everyday world, right? The fact that you can't see it in the everyday world says, well, maybe it's a little bit like magic, but of course it's not, because we at least tell ourselves we understand it by being able to manipulate a set of questions. The challenge is, of course, that quantum systems are fragile. They come as noisy devices. And what we would like to do is to transform that noisy device into some robust quantum processor, and to be able to do it in such a way that we can realize, as a practical issue, the efficiency gains promised by quantum information processing. And that's basically the challenge of this class. We're going to teach you a little bit about coherent control, but mostly what I want to do is to convince you that you can fully understand a quantum system and that you can understand where the powers come from. So I'm an experimentalist. And as an experimentalist, you know, you sit there and you read PRL and there's all these suggestions of new experiments and new procedures. And you think, well, half of them are bloody trivial and they forget all the hard parts. Right? They take some quantum system, they make it idealized, and then they say, well, in this idealized setting, you could do all these wonderful things. And, you know, they kick the experimentalists and say, well, go and do it. And what we want to do is to say, no. You don't have to deal with such idealizations, that you can understand the quantum system completely, you can model it completely, and you can take your theories and your suggestions for experiments, and you can put them in that complete piece. So the goal of this is to be somewhat more complete about describing quantum mechanics than you've seen it otherwise. And of course, therefore, to tie quantum mechanics more closely to a device. And you've heard many comments, quotes from Richard Feynman. You know, the most famous one that everyone would give at this point is to say that anyone who thinks they understand quantum mechanics doesn't understand it. That's an early quote from Feynman. But there's a later quote that says it takes two generations to understand a new technology. And two generations from now, all physics students will understand quantum mechanics. Okay. You're beyond two generations. So the only person in this room who has an excuse for not understanding quantum mechanics is me. You guys are supposed to understand it. Okay? So we're going to try to do to understand it. To understand it, I want to take a few really simple quantum systems and to understand those completely. So we're going to take three quantum systems. The first is a neutron interferometer. Which is a matter wave interferometer. And we'll see that we can describe it in terms of two qubits, one for the path, it'll be a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, and the second for the spin. The neutron has a spin 1/2. And so we'll be able to look at control and quantum dynamics in the system. And we'll do this in three steps. Today, I'll go over a simplified model. We'll look at it, and we'll think about this in terms of pure state dynamics. So that'll be review. And pretty much what you would see in a simple quantum mechanics course. And then we want to build in some variability. So if we're going to build into variability, then we need to build into a density matrix approach. And so we'll talk about density matrices tomorrow. And then I want to introduce ideas of open quantum systems so that we can look at relative maps. And we'll do that on the third day. Yeah?
What do you mean by variability?
So I'll show you. So what I mean is that we have a Hamiltonian, and some frequency in the Hamiltonian is different each time you look at it. Okay, so normally we think of a Hamiltonian as some fixed thing, but now we're going to let it be dynamic. Okay, so the first one, neutron interferometry. The second one we're going to look at is magnetic resonance. And the advantage of looking at magnetic resonance is we can look at control over larger Hilbert spaces. So it'll still be a finite Hilbert space, but we can increase the size of the Hilbert space. And that's important. There's some nice pieces that simply don't fit in the case of two qubits. Also, it gives us more control measures. And almost everything in coherent control was first developed in magnetic resonance. Magnetic resonance goes back to the 50s and has a rich history of being coherent. From the 50s, we've been doing quantum information processing with magnetic resonance. And finally, we're going to look at a defect in diamond. The so-called nitrogen vacancy defect in diamond. And that's going to give us a hybrid quantum system. There, we'll combine quantum systems together, three of them, an optical system, a nuclear spin, and an electron spin. And we'll see what the advantage is and what the complexity is of having different quantum systems talking to each other. Okay, so these are the three we'll go over. We'll cover them in enough detail that once you're out of here, you'll know all about these. Now, then if we were teaching the second half of this course at IQC, following that, I would cover a lot of modalities. Ion traps, superconducting qubits, linear optics, quantum dots. And there, we would approximate the physics and tell you a little bit about it. So the way I teach that course is to say, it's just like I'm teaching it now, to say, okay, we'll cover the first piece in detail. And then once we have those ideas, we'll just apply them quickly to a large number of systems. That second half of the implementations course will be taught in the fall of this year. So you can go and pick that up as you like. I'm going to try to teach this course without jargon. You can remind me of that when I fall into jargon. All right. Good. Okay. So now then, let's start with neutron interferometry. So neutron interferometry starts with a real simple piece. It says, I have a beam of neutrons that go into a blade. So this is my neutron beam. And we're going to make them monochromatic so that they're one energy. Since they're one energy, of course, they're all one velocity. So we say, oh yes, we can describe the momentum of those, and we can do that precisely. The neutrons, of course, have to come from some nuclear event. And they'll be born in a reactor. And I described that a little bit for you in the notes, but it's not important for us. We take neutrons, we create them in a reactor. We then send them through a pool of cold hydrogen where they scatter, right? All neutrons are born hot, so they would have high velocities. And I'm going to interact them with a silicon crystal. And so I would like the neutrons to have a wavelength of about 2.7 angstroms. There's some variability in that. But, you know, say 3 angstrom neutrons. And the velocity of this will be about 1,800 meters per second. So the neutrons are going really slow. Okay. So since I want cold neutrons, the equivalent temperature of these neutrons is about 30 degrees Kelvin. Then I'm going to say, I cake them hot from the reactor, scatter them off cold hydrogen. I scatter them off hydrogen, because if I want two particles to scatter, they should have the same mass, right? Otherwise, they won't thermalize well. And neutrons and hydrogen are about the same mass. So I scatter them off hydrogen. I get a cold beam. I take out only that piece I want and of energy, and I take out only that piece I want of momentum. And now this neutron beam comes, and it hits this crystal. And this is the orientation of the crystal planes that we have here. And so we're looking at Bragg scattering. And I'm going to look at it in the Lowy geometry. I should have brought my power supply. So we're looking at Bragg scattering. Come on. And it's here somewhere. Thank you. Good. Yeah. Lowy?
Blade.
Blade, I'm sorry. Crystal. So this is a blade. I'll explain that. If I don't explain it in the next 2 minutes, ask again. So I have the neutrons coming in. They're interacting with this crystal. And there'll be two output paths. One that looks like the neutron has just gone straight through the crystal. The other, that the neutron has been diffracted. And if I blew up this piece here, then you would see an interaction like this, that we have a neutron coming in. Of course, I've drawn it as a wave. Remember that we've said that the neutron has one energy. So if it's one energy, then the neutron is traveling as a plane wave. So here we said we have one momentum, so I have that we have a plane wave. That's traveling in this case, along X, if you like, I can put a vector there. And so the neutron is traveling. It has a wavelength. And the wavelength of the neutron, of course, it has mass, is the de Broglie wavelength. And so here I show you the de Broglie wavelength interacting with the crystal. And the way you want to think about this is that every atom in this crystal is coherently outputting a wave. And the resultant wave from all the atoms is, again, a plane wave. And if you haven't gone through that calculation, it's easy to do. But the reason I want to show you this is you can see that in this case, I've got one input from the left and two outputs on the right. Now, of course, there's another input I can draw on the left, right? I could have drawn the neutron coming in here. And the diffraction condition would be exactly the same. We would have one transmitted and one diffracted blade, beam. But I need to be able to separate those two, right? Quantum mechanics is linear. So I can't have two inputs that lead to the same output, right? Then I've lost my linearity in quantum mechanics. And so it's easy to show, if you just calculate the scattering of a plane wave, that what happens is in this other beam, you pick up a pi phase shift in the outcoming part of that beam. Okay, so that the scattering wave, if I have my input here, these two come out in phase. If I have my input here, they come out with 180-degree phase shift. And now, of course, if I characterize those two plane waves, then I could distinguish whether I had this input or that input. Okay? Okay. So now let me go back to this question of what is this blade? We have one piece of crystal. I've looked at a two-dimensional scattering effect here. But I want to make a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And so I'm going to make it like this. I'm going to make a Mach-Zehnder interferometer by taking a single crystal of silicon, a big single crystal of silicon, about yay big. And I'll machine into it an interferometer. The interferometer is going to consist of three of these blades. The first one acts to separate the beam. The second one acts as a mirror. And the third blade acts to recombine the beams. And so we have interference effects here. Because so you can see why it looks like a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. Okay? Now we mill it out of a single piece of silicon because I want to have the system aligned perfectly. So if I have one of these interferometers and I align one blade to the neutron beam, then because all the blades are crystallographically aligned relative to each other, then I've aligned all three blades perfectly. So then we have our so-called perfect single crystal interferometer. Okay. So I have my neutrons coming in. They interact with the blade. When they interact with the blade, we have the coherent superposition of two neutron paths that come out of that. Okay? So this looks like a beam splitter, if you like optics. Looks like a Hadamard gate, if you're like computer science. How many people here are from computer science, math, physics, engineering. All right. Good. Okay. So I have neutrons come in. They get spread in a coherent superposition here. This distance is big. It's 10 centimeters, 20 centimeters, depending upon which crystal we pick off the shelf. So there was this old idea that if you had a quantum state and it was too big, then it had to be classical. All right? That would be a piece of magic, and it's not true. If you have a quantum state and it's big, it's hard to keep it quantum, right? But, you know, already we have engineers in the room, so we'll be able to do that. So let's talk about how we're going to describe the system. Let me put a coordinate system here. I've got two paths. So for now, I'm going to describe the interferometer as living in SU2. And so I need to define two basis states. And the way I'm going to do that is if ky is greater than 0, let me see if I use that. I always hate this. In the notes, I'll start, and then I'll use something completely different when I'm lecturing. But by accident, I get it right. Okay, so now we have our two basis states. If you like, you could say they're the eigenstates of sigma z, but we don't even need to. Here's our basis. And they're going to, of course, span all the dynamics that we're looking at in this system. And so here, we can say that the incoming wave, it's just in one of those states. Now, we already saw what Lowy scattering does. Lowy scattering says if the neutron's coming in here, then it gets coherently split between those two blades. And if it would be coming in this way, then it would get coherently split between those two blades, but this path would pick up a phi phase shift. And of course, every time we want to describe the operation of something, we need to describe the operation for every possible input state. So this is easy. We can say that we have some unitary for the first blade. And the unitary for the first blade looks like that. Now here, I've written out the unitary as though the probabilities of ending up in either of those two paths are the same, right? And so just to be clear about this, if we define psi 2 as to be u1 psi input, then this would be 1 over the square root of 2, the equal superposition. Now, of course, it need not be the case that these are equally weighted. And so we could generalize this. I could describe psi 1 as a function of some angle to be cosine of that angle minus sine of the angle, sine of the angle, cosine of the angle. Right. I could define it this way. Okay. We'll use this for now. Later on, we'll come back to looking at this. And you can see that this angle is going to tell us something about effectively how transparent that blade looks. It's going to say, does the neutron want to go straight through? All right. Now, this blade is exactly the same as the first blade, And so when I have a neutron interacting with the second blade, the same thing must happen, that I have one path which is diffracted and one path which is transmitted. And of course, that would be the same for both of these. But in this particular experiment, I'm only interested in what happens to the two paths that recombine so that I can have an interference effect. So I'm not interested in this path. And experimentally, what we do is we put a piece of cadmium here. And cadmium's great. It absorbs all neutrons. So if I put a piece of cadmium there, no neutrons are ever going to get through that. For our purposes, I don't want to keep track of that. So what we do is we say, I'm going to lose that path and describe this interaction as to be just the scattered neutrons. Right? So I've suppressed the diagonal part of U1 because I never want to see the neutrons that are going through. And then I've renormalized. And this is a piece of physics that you'll see in almost every optics experiment and almost any interferometer. It's a process called fair sampling. What we say is that we have the neutrons coming in, and I'm going to look at a small fraction of them. I'm going to look at those neutrons that actually end up having an interference effect. There'll be neutrons that leave the interferometer. In fact, half the neutrons will leave the interferometer. And I have to make an assumption. I have to say that those neutrons don't carry away any interesting information. And that's part of the homework assignment, you'll see. That if these neutrons that would leave the interferometer are allowed to carry with them information different than the neutrons that stay in the interferometer, then my results here will actually not be indicative of this simple closed system. So we don't allow that to happen. Fair sampling. And you notice that I suppressed the factor of 1 over the square root of 2, which appears in front of U1, right? U1, I write it over here again, is equal to 1 over the square root of 2. And I suppress that because I renormalize. I'm saying the half that reach the third blade are the total of all the neutrons in the system. Okay? So there's a nice assumption we build in. Now you can see that this really does look like a mirror. Right? So that if I look at that path, so then if I say that psi 3 is equal to U2, U1, psi n, and psi 2 is that, and we had this state already. It looks like that. I could even get it right. Looks like that. Yeah? So now we still have an equal superposition. You might ask, well, why do we use a blade for a mirror? Why don't we just use a mirror? It turns out that it's very hard to make a mirror for neutrons. That I can make a mirror for neutrons if the neutrons are incredibly slow, if they have wavelengths of about 9 angstroms. But at 2 angstroms or 3 angstroms, I can't do that. Yeah, you have a question?
Yeah, 1 or 2. Maybe you want to leave this to homework, I don't know. But when you said the information lost by our ignoring half neutrons, that information is not important?
Oh, no. If the neutrons that leave the interferometer carry with them unique information, that's very important. Okay, so that's what you'll see in homework. So fair sampling says that the neutrons that we're not averaging over, the ones we've neglected, are not special. Okay, that's what fair sampling says. You had another question? Okay, perfect. So now then we have our two paths. They get to come together at the third blade. And we need to do one more piece. If I have two plane waves beating against each other, which is what will happen at the third blade, here, right? We get U1 again at the third blade. Two inputs, two outputs. If I have an interference effect, then I'd like to have a phase that I could adjust. So I want to have some way that I can adjust the relative phase. Now remember that the neutron is coming in with the precise energy. So you can think about the neutron as being an infinite plane wave. And maybe this is too trivial for you. But, you know, you have an infinite plane wave, right? It just doesn't work. Just keeps moving, right? And clearly, at any time, I could describe another plane wave that was phase shifted from it. And so if I want to have the plane waves represented by this path and this path phase shifted from each other, then I need to slow down the neutrons. And that's pretty easy to do. So how do you slow down something? You change the potential, right? Look at the solution of Schrodinger's equation and ask, what is the k vector in Schrodinger's equation? Well, it depends on the potential, right? It's the energy minus the potential. Yeah? If you haven't seen that, it's in the notes. So just like if I had a straw sitting in a glass of water, and you would see the straw is bent. We can do the same thing with neutrons. And so we put in here a phase flag. Which we make out of silica. Now this crystal is a crystal of silicon. So that's just silica as silicon in a three-dimensional diamond lattice, one big crystal. This material is amorphous. And the reason that we use silica is, which is just silicon oxide, it doesn't absorb neutrons. Okay, it has a different coherent cross-section than air, which is what the neutrons are going through between there. And the density is very uniform so that we can make a nice control element. So we're going to use silica to introduce a phase flag. I'm going to rotate about that direction. And you should have no trouble convincing yourself that this path length and this path length are slightly different than each other as I rotate that blade. And of course, what's the phase that we want? It has to be the phase difference between those two beams. Right? So here I could say, oh yes, I have a phase flag. And it's going to have two phases associated with it, one for each of those paths. But But then I'm perfectly free to rewrite this. Like so. And so there only becomes one phase, which is this difference in phase. That's a global phase. Therefore, it has no effect. And therefore, we just have one phase in the system. Yep. Okay, so now I have my two neutrons. I have one neutron. I have one neutron spread over coherently over two paths, and they're going to come together here. So, psi 4 is equal to, well, let's put in the phase. U2, U1, psi n. And so we're just going to pick up a phase shift. And in this case, I put it in that path. So that's OK. Like so. And then we recombine on that fourth blade. So that on the third blade, like so. So now we have the output of this. Okay. So if I redraw the neutron interferometer so that things don't get too messy. We have two measurement systems, two detectors. For historic reasons, the paths are called O and H. Not important, but we'll use the terminology anyways. And here, I'm going to put a helium-3 detector. So I described in the notes how a helium-3 detector works. What it does is it captures a neutron. So the cross-section for helium-3 capturing a neutron is huge. So every neutron that goes and interacts, that arrives at this helium-3 detector, will be detected, okay? And once it's detected, it creates hydrogen and tritium, and these are charged, and we're just measuring the charge in that detector. So we're able to do that very well. So we have two detectors, and you can think about them as being perfect. We have our state here, just before those two detectors. And so we can easily calculate the intensity at each of those detectors. Of course, at the O beam, we're going to keep just that term that is in the plus one path, right? Just that term corresponding to this element of the state. And so the intensity is going to be 1/4 minus 1 minus e to the I phi times minus 1 minus e to the plus I phi. So this is going to be 1/2 of 1 plus cosine phi. That's the intensity of the O beam. And the intensity of the H beam is correspondingly that. And it will reassure you, I hope, that the sum of the intensities add up to one, right? Every time a neutron comes in, as long as we forget about this fair sampling, in our picture of this interferometer, every neutron hits the detector. Now, experimentally, this works really well. And I didn't tell you, but you can calculate. With this velocity, the neutrons spend about 10 to 20 microseconds in the interferometer, depending upon how big an interferometer we use. And the counts that we have at the end of the day over here, we have about one neutron per second. We might be able to get up a little bit higher than that, but that's the order of magnitude. So there's never two neutrons in the interferometer at once, right? That the interference we're seeing is the interference of the plane wave of the neutron spread over two paths, beating against itself as we change the phase, relative phase between those two paths. Okay, so this is about the simplest version of one qubit that we can have. Any questions on how the neutron interferometer works in this simple idealized version? Okay. So we calculate all these things for you. And here I show a plot of the intensity at the two detectors versus the phase. Whoops. And here's a plot of the real thing. So you can see that it's similar to what we have described, that we have two detectors. The O beam and the H beam. I haven't offset the H beam. These are correctly just intensity in counts per second. Okay, and this axis is written in terms of the difference in thickness of this phase flag, but of course the difference in thickness is strictly proportional to the phase. So we could calculate that. In fact, I ask you to do that. I ask you to tell me for what difference you get a pi phase shift. That's pretty simple. So now you see that we get something approximately right, but one of the goals of this class is to say that we're not interested in approximately right. That this is just the starting point. What we want to know is we want to get it right in the details. Okay? And so I want to know why this doesn't go down to zero. I want to know why this doesn't go down to zero. Okay? So we want to look at these, you know, the fact that it's a nice cosine wave, that looks pretty good. The fact that the intensity is constant as a function of the phase, that looks pretty good, right? But the other pieces don't look so good. So that's what we're going to spend some time having a look at. Now, it's important as we do this that we also think about what it means for information processing. If I take a system and I get this result, then it's easy to show that this is uniquely quantum mechanical. And we'll talk about your tutorial problem in a second, which aims at doing that. But if I add this piece, look at the DC level here. Let's just look at that piece there. What does it say? It says that there are neutrons that hit this detector regardless of the phase flag, right? So it says that there are neutrons that aren't seeing an interference effect. And that's a big loophole in quantum mechanics. And so if you want to prove that your system is uniquely quantum mechanical, well, then we need to worry about that. Because that may open up such a big loophole that all of a sudden the system becomes classical. And so we want to understand not only where do these effects come from, how can we get rid of them, but also in terms of our goal of reaching efficiencies by having a uniquely quantum mechanical device. Remember the first part of the lecture. We said quantum mechanics is different. It's different in a profoundly interesting way, and it's useful. But absolutely, if I can come up with a classical model for a quantum system, then quantum mechanics is no longer different, period, and certainly has no more power than that corresponding classical system. And so we need to worry about those things, and we will do that. Now, I have to tell you, there's Dima. All the data is taken by Dima. That's not his lab. And one of the pieces that we could imagine is the issue. Is I said, that the blade I'm going to use, I want it to be a blade that gives me an equal superposition over the two paths. We could have replaced that with this operator, a blade where the superposition is not equal. And of course, most likely, we have this condition. And here, I show you what the intensity would be depending upon that angle, which unfortunately here I call B and there I call A. But if the probability of being diffracted becomes small, then of course I see very little interference effects. As the probability increases, then we see the result that we want. And of course, if we continued making the blade thicker, then we would see these things would oscillate. But notice that this behavior by itself does not fully describe what happens in the real data, because this blue curve still comes down all the way to zero. All right, so we say, here's an easy thing to check, but it's not enough, okay? So I want you to have a look, read through the notes. We'll talk about that next class. I'm assuming, but now here's your chance to tell me I'm wrong, that all of you know what a Bloch sphere representation is. Is that true? Okay, not sure if it's true for everyone. A Bloch sphere says that there's a mapping between SU2, this quantum system, in ordinary space. And it says, hey, if I'm here, we have the state being up. If I'm here, I have the other basis state. And if I'm on the equator, then I have an equal superposition. And as I move along the equator, I pick up a phase. And of course, if I'm not along the equator, I'm at some angle here, then I replace the square root of 2 with sines and cosines in front of those two. Okay? So it's a good way of understanding what's going on in interferometry, so I ask you to use that. Finally, let me cover the last little piece. Here's my challenge for you for the tutorial. I want you to look at the interferometer behaving just like we've described it, And then what happens when I put a beam block here? I want you to show me that you can't come up with a classical model that describes both of those two behaviors consistently, right? Be one classical model for two experiments, okay? And so it'll be a very first step at teasing out some of what we mean by what's uniquely quantum mechanical. Good. Okay, so we'll stop here. Anyways, thanks for coming by. You can find me in Rack 2 when you have questions. And look through these things. Make sure you work through the problems. It's important.